From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Well, here we are, entering yet another new situation. Hopefully one with less anxiety, even with many unknowns. The relief of a new presidency brings hope, yet the sober reality of what is still before us means our daily lives are still circumscribed by pandemic necessity. Although many of us will be breathing easier this week, really at this point, all I want is to get sweaty on a packed dance floor, then relax with a drink in a space so thrumming with people, I can't hear any of the conversation around me. I envision myself looking into a glass and finding an internal moment of quiet to sip and enjoy. So let's start off this week with anticipation of what change can come. Let's drink to new hope with intention. Just pull into a small mini mall parking lot on Hillhurst in Los Feliz and open your trunk. Fill it up with bottles and hear the clank as you drive from a visit to Lou Wine and Tastings. With an avuncular approach and professorial knowledge of the wine he sells, proprietor Lou Amder is here with recommendations for those of us not participating in a dry January. He's going to also share how to best drink our wine with intention. Hi, Lou.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's so great to have you back. So 2020 has been, I guess, a huge year for imbibing. Did you notice any trends in what your customers were drinking?
Oh, for sure. People were drinking, they're drinking more, but they were drinking less expensive wines. The category of the liter size bottle is really, really hot for us right now. And so it's hard to even keep some of them on the shelf. But every day people are coming, even if they're getting a six pack or a case of wine, they want some liters of inexpensive, delicious wines that are just meant for everyday consumption.
So rather than just swilling back anything, let's talk about drinking with intention. The phrase gets bandied about, but what does it mean for you? And more importantly, how do we go about doing it?
Well, remember early on during the pandemic when the CDC cautioned us not to drink or at least limit our drinking? And I know that for me...
I'm sorry.
Exactly. Laugh is the only thing I can say. And for a lot of us, our response was, no. When you asked me, when you sent me the email and asked me this question about drinking with intentionality, what popped in my head was an observation that the brilliant radical feminist Ellen Willis once made about the war on drugs. And she asked, why do people take them? And her response was, because they feel good. And yet we live in a society that's so deeply inflected with Puritanism, it fills us with anxiety about drug taking as a moral failure.
One of the things that I find in my own life helps me to not overdo whatever it is learning about stories, because then it expands my experience of whatever it is, drinking or eating. I become aware of more than just the momentary sensuality of ingestion. So let's talk about Pinot Donnie, a grape varietal that is perhaps quite suited for these strange times. Tell us about it.
It's a medieval grape variety that may have been documented. We don't know quite sure the identity of the grape going back several centuries, but maybe as old as the 10th century, the 900s. It is a variety that at one time was very widely grown all throughout the Loire and all the way east, even in Burgundy, they grew it as well. You get to imagine a time in which clonal selection was not a thing. And that people just grew grapes. They made selections. But if you had, for example, a selection of Pinot, you know, in your field, you may have, I don't know, 30 or 50 biotypes of Pinot Noir growing. And amongst those biotypes would be other grapes as well. So Pinot Denis was very widely distributed, even in Burgundy. It's hard to even realize that almost all the wine we drink today are made from grapes that have a history that's relatively modern. Cabernet, for example, is a relatively modern grape. Merlot, relatively modern grape. compared to something like Pinot Donis that's much, much older. So the reason why I mention that history is that it is, in a way, an untamed grape. And it's a grape that in a normal, I say normal with some caveats, because with global warming, normal classic vintages are becoming fewer and far in between. But in an average vintage, you struggle to get to 12.5% with this grape. In a warm vintage, you'll get a very different wine, a very generous wine. But in a normal vintage, you're getting a wine that's 11 to 12% alcohol. The wines are typically made in a style that's fresh, light, low in extract, typically not oaked. It's a wine of a type that more modern folk use the phrase glue-glue, which is French for glug-glug-glug-glug-glug. So wines you can just kind of crush and guzzle. So it's a grape that seems to be consummately made for our times. It's a grape that was just waiting for us.
So on one hand, you say that it's not for everyone. And on the other hand, you say it's like a glue-glue wine. So what are the parts of it that make it not for everyone?
It is sort of a time capsule of the food ways of the sensibility of days gone by. So it can have a kind of rhubarby, cranberry, sour cherry thing that I love. And not everybody is a rhubarb person. So if you've ever eaten a raw piece of rhubarb and you kind of like it, maybe this is a wine for you.
What other bottles do you recommend to start off the new year, and what foods should we pair them with?
Sticking within the idiom of glue glue, I love Raphael Sancerre's La Galoche, old school, organically farmed, light as a feather, no crap added Beaujolais. There's also glue glue from all over the world. Martin Goyer's aptly named Vino Rosso Leggero from the hills above Bolzano, or Mario Rivera's Clarete from Bierzo in the northwest of Spain. These are all wines that are light bodied, low in alcohol, low in extract. They're dry. And if it were warm out, you could stick them in the fridge. I'm not sure why I chose all red wines, but that's just where my head's at. On the other end of the spectrum are wines that are the opposite of glue glue. And these are fortified wines that can be 18 to 22% alcohol. And sometimes they spend years or decades in barrel. The French have a phrase for this. The French always seem to have phrases for things like this. They call these wines vins de méditation. And as the name implies, these are wines that may facilitate a moment, brief as it may be, of meditation. And old school Bagnoles, Bagnoles Rancio, which sits in barrel for years, sometimes decades, is the consummate French form of this. But my favorite are old Madeiras. And they're not inexpensive. A bottle of good 15-year-old Madeira can run you $75 to $100. Enrique and Enrique is a Madeira that I carry. There are others as well that are very good. If you can get your hands on a bottle of Serchal, which is a type of Madeira, these are wines that, unlike glue glue, invite you to slow down and consider the noetic world inside of your head as the volatilized vapors fill your skull, and they evoke things that, and they light up your brain in a way that nothing else does.
Lou, it is such a pleasure to have you on. You speak about wine like no one else. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
That was Lou Amdor. We've been discussing what to drink in this new year. Visit him and have a chat at Lou Wine and Tastings in Los Feliz. Up next, a forager finds a new audience on TikTok. Hear her story when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. From her Ohio environs, TikTok star, aka Black Forager, Alexis Nicole Nelson, joyfully shares her foraging adventures from deep in the snow, often with song.
This is the cattail, and I know what you are thinking. Some nice dudes on here told me that they ain't good for eating. Well, gang, what a told you that those nice dudes were wrong?
Hank, don't hate me.
And what if I told you I'd eat cattails, but told you in a song, meet the cattail, rhizomes in the mud.
Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Evan. Oh my gosh. Isn't listening to your own voice a trip?
I just have to tell you that your songs bring me such pure joy when I am just in the depths of despair.
Well, writing them has been like a really big source of joy during the, I'd call it tumultuous, last 9 or 10 months that everyone's been going through. So to hear that it makes other people smile, that's fantastic. It makes me so happy to hear.
When did you turn to TikTok and creating these songs?
So, funny enough, I started my TikTok almost exactly a year ago to the day. My day job is in digital marketing focused on social media. So, of course, with TikTok being the big new thing, my boss wanted me to know how it worked, and I would much rather fail under my own name than by the company's name. So around March of 2020, I posted my first, hey, I know you're nervous about going to the grocery store. I am too. Here's 5 plants in your neighborhood that you can harvest and eat different parts of. And I didn't think anything of it. I've foraged as a hobby for a really long time. And this was just kind of my first time committing it to any kind of video. And I woke up the next day and it had tens of thousands of views, which for me at that time was absolutely insane. So I figured, hey, I'll just keep taking people along for everything that I'm doing and all the kind of weird foods that I make and the songs that I sing, regardless of whether anyone's listening or not.
So let's go back a bit. Where did you grow up and where do you live now?
I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I currently live in Columbus, Ohio. So I have not strayed too far from home.
And how did you start looking for edibles in the great outdoors?
Well, if we want to go all the way back, my mom is extremely into gardening. That's kind of been her meditative practice. So I remember being very little, probably 4 or 5, and being outside with my mom, as I was often wont to do, and she pointed out a type of grass that looked a little different than the rest of the grass. When you broke it, it smelled like onions. And she's like, well, this is onion grass. You can eat it if you want to. It comes up as a weed. And I don't know why that stuck with me all throughout the years, but as I got older, you know, I went to summer camps out in the middle of the woods, and a camp counselor would haphazardly tell us about an edible plant, and I would just commit it to memory. I'd, you know, go to the library and read up about it later. And it's just always been an interest of mine, this kind of intertwining between nature and the food we eat and how that makes us kind of have a bigger respect. You know, I feel like when you can identify things in nature, you respect it a little bit more than you would otherwise. And now it's just grown into a full-blown obsession.
You're a vegan. Did the veganism intersect with foraging that was already happening? And has it sort of powered it in a way?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it that way, it really does kind of seem like a logical step. I've technically been foraging in some sort of capacity since I was 5 or 6 years old. But now it's wonderful because it does add this kind of seasonal variety to my already very completely plant-based diet. It keeps things interesting. It makes me constantly challenge myself in the kitchen more so than I would have 5 years ago and more so than I would have 5 years before that. It's definitely challenging, but I love those kind of challenges.
Can you give us an example of something that you foraged recently while it's been intense winter for you and what you created to eat from it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are in the middle of winter mushroom season for us right now in Ohio. And that typically in my neck of the woods means winter oysters and enoki. So I've been harvesting a lot of winter oysters, turning them into, honestly, jerky. Mostly mushroom jerky is my vice. My dehydrator is running with new batches of it multiple times a week, pretty much as fast as I can find mushrooms.
How much of your daily eating includes what you forage?
I love this question. So it really varies during the year. Since we are in the winter, I would say that everything that I make for myself typically at the very least incorporates a foraged spice. But I would say in terms of volume, it's probably somewhere in between 10 and 20% during the winter. But when we get to, especially like late summer, early fall, when you have a lot of more calorie-dense, plentiful foods coming into fruition, I could have an entire day where everything that I'm making, with the exception of maybe like an olive oil that's tossed into a batter or tossed onto some greens, is something that I foraged for myself.
This is a moment filled with Karens who want to police the whereabouts of people of color. How do you deal with that as you look for food in public parks and other public spaces?
Oh, golly. Well, the first step, honestly, is knowing the rules for where you are. I will say with a wink and a nudge, not necessarily saying that I do it myself, but I'm not saying that you're always following those rules, because some of them are antiquated and were put in place to do harm to Indigenous people and to people of color. But knowing the rules for where you are, when it comes to public parks and city parks especially, and so that's step one. Because if you're in a space and say you have a permit to be gathering there, like I do for Wayne National Forest, someone comes up to you and is skeptical about what you're doing, and you know, you have a piece of paper to show them to be like, well, I can actually be doing this and maybe we can learn some stuff together. Do you want to know what it is that I am picking? Sometimes the answer is yes. Most of the time, the answer is no. And while I often want to get angry and be frustrated with people who are overly skeptical or even rude when they come up to me asking me what I'm doing, I really try to err on the side of giving them the benefit of the doubt and offering them education and a glimpse into what I'm doing, if at all possible. But if someone is seeming particularly persnickety, I also know when to call it and to just head home. It's a weird time to be a tall, loud, Black woman doing an activity that someone can't immediately identify.
You now have this enormous audience. Where are you with followers on TikTok? Almost at 500,000, right?
Oh my God, I know. I think I'm sitting around 450,000 right now.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. After we're allowed out of our bubbles, do you see yourself doing a lot of tours, taking people out?
Oh, absolutely. I have already been talking to folks at parks that are, you know, wanting and willing to host foraging walkabouts, because I love teaching people in person. I ended up becoming a camp counselor at that same overnight camp that I went to as a kid. And my favorite thing to teach was kind of like the wilderness skills, like these are the things you can eat in the woods. This is how you make a lean-to, like, you know, this is how to survive if for whatever reason you got stuck out here. There's something really cool about watching recognition of plants happening with people. And I honestly just believe that there is a degree of reverence for your surroundings that comes from getting to know your surroundings better. I love our environment. I would love for generations upon generations to continue to get to enjoy it in equally, if not more, pristine levels than it is in now. So anything that I can do that helps folks feel more connected to their surroundings, it just feels like a win for me.
I am so grateful that you came on the show today. Thank you so much, Alexis.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan. I'm sorry I had the most loquacious answers to all of your questions.
Oh, no, we love that.
We love that.
That was forager and all-around sunny human Alexis Nicole Nelson. You can find her on TikTok and Instagram at Black Forager. Nature deserves attention, especially when recovering from a cataclysm. There's a goat ranch in the San Gabriel Mountains called Angeles Crest Creamery. It's one of those places that feels like your own personal secret. Drive barely an hour out of LA and you're in the forest with frolicking goats who are taken care of by Gloria Putnam and her partner, Christian Serial. A couple of months into the pandemic, a friend and I met up there for a socially distanced hangout. It was heaven. I stayed overnight in a sweet little cabin and ended up taking a bath in an outdoor tub surrounded by goats. But a few weeks later, the bobcat fire swept through. Gloria's been documenting the fire's effect on the ranch in her newsletter, The Obligate Resprouter. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, Evan.
What is your agricultural mission at Angeles Crest Creamery?
Sure. Well, when we moved here in 2014, the idea was to try and explore a way of making food for humans in arid Southern California without using imported water. So we wanted to try and practice a very ancient kind of agriculture, basically walking around in the mountains with goats, which takes advantage of the fact that the goats can eat the plants that grow here naturally with just the very little water that we get in terms of rainfall.
And you call this regenerative mountain agriculture.
Yeah, I feel like that regenerative phrase is getting used a lot lately and means a lot of things. So I'm not using it as much anymore. And it's also kind of a newer word. And actually what we're doing is Neolithic, right? It's the original agriculture that humans practiced even before growing grains. It doesn't exhaust the soil in the way that other kinds of agriculture eventually does.
And there was plenty of forage for the goats up there on your land, which is a combination of chaparral and woodland.
That's right. We're on a 70-acre inholding in the Angeles National Forest, and it's a combination, like you say, of kind of sagebrush-dominated chaparral and pinyon juniper woodland. And that's a really ideal diet for goats who are browsers rather than grazers like cows or sheep who mostly eat grass, which, of course, we don't have a lot of here in Southern California. So they eat more like deer, browsing on shrubs and trees, and this is a really natural diet for them here.
So what was the impact of the fire?
Well, the first impact, of course, is that we had to leave. It's not usual for us to pack up our goats and take a trip, but we did just that. We evacuated 60 goats about 6 miles away from here to basically a dirt lot behind a friend's ranch and set up a kind of makeshift camp with fencing for the goats. And we brought water and we brought a trailer that we could sleep in and hay and all the things we needed to kind of wait things out. And the fire, you know, on the 20th of September, the fire came through the east side of our ranch pretty intensely and took out, about a third of our forage land completely, just left moonscape. And then over the next week, the fire continued to burn on the property and gradually took, I don't know, another 30% or so of our forage land.
So let's talk about the areas that were burned, because the effect on the land is both one of fire and the chemical impact of fire suppression materials, right?
Yes. And actually, we talked to some people from the USDA nutritionist about the fire suppression materials, which is the PhosChek, right, which they drop from airplanes as a retardant. And actually, that is pretty safe. So even though there are some parts where we have remaining forage, but they're covered in PhosChek, it's not particularly toxic or dangerous. So we don't need to avoid those areas. So the main impact is really where the plants are just gone.
And what kind of plants did you lose?
Well, we lost both a combination of both the chaparral and the pinyon juniper woodland that we talked about before. So in the chaparral, there are a lot of species that will resprout. So they will come back over several years, especially our scrub oaks. And some of them will reseed, like the sagebrush, and that'll take longer, but we'll eventually have sagebrush again. And then we lost a lot of pinyon pines, which unfortunately the process of regeneration for pinyon pines is very, very slow because they really are killed by fire and they have to grow again from seed brought in from remaining trees. And they are very, very slow growing trees. So probably in my lifetime, I won't get to see the pinyon pine forest again.
What will you do with the dead trees that you now have on the property? Will you log them out or will you keep them?
We're going to keep them. They serve an ecological purpose that helps the forest regenerate. So one of the main purposes of snags, so they're called, these kind of tree trunks that are left behind after a fire, is that they attract birds, both for hollows, for, you know, birds that actually nest in holes in trees, and also just as perches. And birds do a lot of the work of regenerating the forest by bringing in the seeds. So you really want to have all those attractive spots for the birds to hang out on the snags so that they will do their work as quickly as possible. So also then as those snags fall down, they create little pockets of moisture and shade right under them on the ground. And that becomes the nursery for like new pinyon pine seedlings, for example. So there's a lot of purposes for all that wood, and we're not going to remove it. Everyone that I've talked to about fire ecology has told me that mostly things that people want to do after a fire to help regenerate are not particularly helpful. We're interested to let it go through its natural process of recovery and to really document that and learn from it.
Given that you've lost so much forage, what is going to happen with the goats now? Are you going to maintain the same size of herd? Do you have to bring food to them now?
Yeah, that's a really challenging part of this for us, not just financially, but for me kind of personally and intellectually, because the whole purpose of the project was to demonstrate how to make food using the natural environment, not to bring in food or to bring in water. And actually, when I buy hay to feed the goats, I'm basically just bringing in water because that hay is grown in the desert by pumping groundwater, you know, that really needs to stay in the ground. So there's nothing sustainable about bringing in hay. Our goal is to try and figure out a low enough cost fencing regime that we can actually exclude the goats from the burned areas and still be able to forage them next summer in the areas that remain. So we actually got a grant from the American Farmland Trust to do one small fencing project, which is going to be our first attempt. And if it's successful and we think it's a good method, we're going to replicate it on other areas of the ranch where we need to protect the land. You know, it really is a long recovery. I think it's at least 5 years before those burn scars can be forage land again without that damaging them.
And what about your hospitality mission? I know the pandemic has really had the first and biggest effect on that last year, before the fire even started. Will you be restarting that when the pandemic wanes?
The fire was a traumatic event for Christian and I also. So I think that we're excited to welcome people back when it's safe. And also when we're feeling like we have a little bit more to give in terms of hosting, which takes a lot of energy. And I think we need a little bit of time for ourselves to heal. So yeah, we'll see.
Your newsletter has one of the greatest names ever. It's called The Obligate Resprouter. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. And it's a botanical term. In fire ecology, an obligate resprouter is a plant that the only way it regenerates after a fire is by resprouting from its base. And we have a lot of resprouters, obligate resprouters here on the ranch. But yeah, it's a referring to mostly to our oaks, which are going to be our first plants to come back and remind us that not all is lost.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for finding the time in your schedule to come in and talk with us about it. The newsletter is such a thoughtful endeavor and so educational. It's wonderful to read and learn so much about this part of California in which we all live.
Thank you. I mean, the newsletter is really an extension of the mission of the original project, which is learning and sharing. So now what we're learning and sharing is more about fire ecology and these longer processes in nature.
And I would also say that you and Christian are also obligate resprouters.
I sure hope so.
Take care.
Thank you.
That was Gloria Putnam of Angeles Crest Creamery in the San Gabriel Mountains. To subscribe to the newsletter or donate to the Hay Fund, go to AngelusCrestCreamery.com. In a minute, a deep dive into the Filipino comfort food, balut. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Cultural identity is fascinating and complex. Food has become an apt lens through which it can be explored not just within a self-same culture, but outside it as well. Independent scholar and folklorist Margaret Magat looks at balut, the fertilized eggs of the Philippines, to explore the making of culinary capital in the Filipino diaspora. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Evan.
What is a balut egg? How does it differ from our understanding of a hard-boiled egg, for example?
A balut egg is an embryonic egg or an egg that's been fertilized and allowed to progress so that it's at least 17 to 21 days old. It's usually boiled and eaten with salt or some other condiment, but it's basically a partially formed duck or chicken.
What are the components? If you were to completely open the shell, what would be inside it?
First, you would see that there's some liquid, which is basically a really tasty soup. And then there's the albumen, which is a hard part that is the white of the egg. And then there's the embryo, which has been surrounded a little bit by the yolk. And that would be a balut egg.
When is it eaten and by whom?
In Southeast Asia, a lot of people eat balut. And in the Philippines, a lot of people eat it. There's kids and parents and grandparents. Whenever you're having a social party, a drinking party called inuman, a lot of men eat it during that time. It's basically a snack food, and you can see it pretty much in areas that is transportation hubs or in the street corners.
And how is it eaten? If I were to see some for sale on the street and buy one, what would I do? What are the moves that I make to eat it?
Well, the typical way to eat it would be first to just tap or crack the wide part, and then one would sip or suck the juice out, which is the soup, and then you would slowly peel it until you see the egg, and then you would basically take a bite of the yolk and the embryo, and you would tend to finish it in 2 to 3 bites and not linger over it.
Are the bones of the embryo formed to the point of where they are hard, or are they still a very soft texture?
They would still be a soft texture. So 17 days, they're partially formed, and when you eat the egg, you can still somewhat say it's chewy and a little bit, I wouldn't say crunchy, but you can tell that there's bones there, the more developed the egg is.
So basically in situ in the Philippines, it's completely embraced, it's eaten by everyone, it's folded into daily life and fiesta life. What happens when it travels outside its home?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's one of these foods that has the power to conjure a landscape. At least that's my argument. You can take it anywhere, and it can be produced in Greenland, for example, if you're in Greenland, or in Italy, if you're in Italy. But when you eat it, you feel undeniably Filipino, if you're of Filipino heritage. And if you're not, and you're surrounded with Filipino friends, and you eat it, you sort of feel like you're part of being an honorary Filipino. And I think that the reason that it travels like that and becomes like that is because it's been considered such a part of the culture that it has the ability to make one go back into that particular landscape, as it were.
What's interesting about balut to me, and what you touched on in one part of the book, was its unmistakable, quote, authenticity, which when we talk about authenticity within food terms, it's just such a slippery word that often means nothing. But could you talk about that level of authenticity?
Well, as you know, as you mentioned, that there are foods that particularly bring out people's ire, especially when they claim this is authentic, or my version is the real version. And I think where balut is particularly intriguing is that it is unapologetically itself.
Obviously, one of the aspects of balut that we have to talk about is the performative identity that comes into play. And there's so many different ones when it comes to either the diaspora community introducing it to non-Filipino Americans or non-Filipinos of whatever background they are interacting with it. Could you talk about some of that performative identity?
The reason I wrote this book was because I wanted to set the record straight. And what I mean by that is that I saw lots of people using it through the course of the last 20 years since Fear Factor first came out with balut in 2002. I saw a lot of different ways that people were using it, and there was no attempt to provide a cultural context to it. The ways that people take this food and use it in different contexts to me were interesting because, in one hand, non-Filipinos who use it in a lot of blogs, for instance, if you type balut challenge, you'll see millions of hits on videos, whether it says Australian eating balut or Italian tries balut for the first time or white American eats balut, and they'll be seen as someone who's more of an intrepid eater. And then the traditional way of eating it is usually a person, a Filipino, of Filipino heritage, who is eating it to regain a sense of Filipino-ness and to go back to the memory of being at home. So that those are just two types of performing identities that comes with eating the egg.
One of the most interesting people that you talked to for me was a woman, I believe her name is Army, who hand sold them at a farmer's market in Fremont. Can you talk about her and her relationship to balut and what kind of she feels her mission is in terms of selling them?
Army feels that balut should be tried by practically everybody. Army engages with everyone who comes to her stall because she really wants them to understand the cultural context of what is balut and not to come away into thinking that it's repulsive. So the way that she educates people into the right cultural context, I think, is key because it encourages people to try it and see it with an open eye, open eyes, and just to give it, you know, to give it a try.
It's such a fascinating book. I really just thank you for coming here and talking to us so thoughtfully about a subject that is so often just demonized and seen in this just disturbing, xenophobic way.
Yes. And I hope that I set the record straight, at least provide some kind of cultural insight, because we really need more understanding and less, as you mentioned it, less xenophobic portrayals of other people's practices.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Evan.
That was independent scholar and folklorist Margaret Magat. Her book, Balut, is an important piece of scholarship. As the pandemic continues to ravage our restaurants, we step back for another individual's story for In the Weeds. In downtown LA on 9th Street, just a stone's throw from the formerly bustling Santee Alley, is the tiny, light-filled Brazilian restaurant Woodspoon. It's Natalia Pereira's passion project to bring the diasporic food of Minas Gerais to Los Angeles. Woodspoon is this week's In the Weeds.
Hello, my name is Natalia. I'm the chef and owner of Woodspoon Restaurant in downtown Los Angeles. Woodspoon is located in downtown Los Angeles at 107 West 9th. For people familiar to downtown Los Angeles, is right in the center of everything between theaters and the fashion and the garment district. I opened Woodspoon in 2006. And my main focus was to represent and recreate a feeling of home. I'm from Minas, a well-known, respected state in Brazil. And Brazil is quite large, with an incredible agriculture and gastronomy. And from the state of Minas Gerais, meaning precious stones, I feel that a kitchen is an incredible classroom. I also, for me, that I didn't have a formal education, I have learned to other countries and other culinary trades and places to educate myself. I had the need to make this particular dish traditionally eaten on Sunday after you have spaghetti and chicken stew for lunch. The leftover, my mom would make a pie out of the chicken. And I tried to make that pie, and I did, and I offered to the people that I was staying with, and they were quite thrilled about it. After that, I wanted to make butter, and I wanted to make pão de queijo, a cheese bread based out of cassava flour and cheese. And just to give me a little sense of home, I couldn't speak a word of English, but I didn't have to talk to the tomato or to the carrot or to the fresh garlic. It was more a relationship. I have a lot of respect for food because at points in my life, I didn't have it, which is another story. But so food has been for me a best friend, a companion, a form of education, a feeling of a home. And that's what I built with Spoon, so I can share my home with perfect strangers, I call. And a lot of these strangers has now become family to me and supporters and have been part of my dream. I have passion for what I do. Every time that door opens up at Woodspoon, I feel almost unable to describe the emotion of it. Woodspoon is a restaurant, 30 seats, 850 square foot altogether, 3 people in the kitchen, 2 people in the front of the house. Now that we are all under COVID, my tables remain set, the seats are empty. Also, Woodspoon, the team that we have, some of them has been with me for 11 years. I felt compelling compassion to provide, again, a sense of a home to them. And that has been also said through many of our wonderful patrons and guests, that when they are at the restaurant, they feel they are at home, or somebody loves them, made that meal for them. And that is something that I cherish, very much so. So during this hard time with all of us are in it. I just feel that, you know, empathy and we must be together, but apart, but be supportive of one another. I made changes on my menus so I can continue to serve some of the dishes that were, you know, asked for or questioned about it. For example, chicken and okra. We do a corn grits with short ribs, which is a delicious stew that my mom used to make for me during the winter. And it's just to say that food is still the bridge that connects us all. I will stand strong as much as I can with the difficulties that we are facing. But I would like to continue to feed my community and use that platform to help others and support others and cease hunger if it's possible. So I do believe that, you know, cook is my passion. It's a very intimate thing to prepare a meal to someone. It takes me home or a perfect idea of a home. Woodspoon menu is basically a, you know, my creation, things that my mom made for me. My brother's favorite appetizers, which is the pastel Portuguese risoli with shrimp and coconut. I love my chicken and okra. The chicken papai has been something that people have been craving. And that is something that takes me back on my Sundays in Vianópolis. It's a little town known for a good cachaça. And I would love to be able to create different meals that represent my culture and who I am. If you would come to Woodspoon, I would suggest for you to get either the beef grill, comes with the rice, beans. We do yuca fries or plantains, a vinaigrette, a farofa, a little condiment with onions, eggs, and yuca, and collard greens, which I absolutely love. And you choose your protein. That'll be probably what I would suggest if you're coming to Woodspoon for the first time. We need to have a reminder that we are still here. And so there is so much in the food world, from fresh scallions from the backyard in the garden to, you know, warm eggs from the chicken that just layered and still singing. All those things, it's like it's one's life, it's one story. And I think it's worth it to be preserved and shared. And we all have it. So I think people should come out and share what they know in times where we all need some kind of a connection to one another to remind us of who we are.
That was Natalia Pereira of Woodspoon. You can support her by ordering takeout from the restaurant and also by going on her website and pre-ordering her book, My Life in Recipes. It will feature photography, recipes, and stories. Coming up, what's better than a plate of perfectly roasted potatoes? Those same potatoes wrapped up in a breakfast burrito. Some inspiration from the farmer's market is up next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It's been unseasonably warm in Southern California this past week, but the market is full of winter vegetables. Jillian Ferguson is there now with her weekly report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I am at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week with Salima Saunders, who courageously opened a new restaurant in the middle of the pandemic. Salima opened Uplifter's Kitchen on Ocean Park in Santa Monica in August, and she's here today shopping for her cafe menu. Hi, Salima.
Hi, Jillian.
So before we get into what you're shopping for, just tell us a little bit about Uplifter's Kitchen and the kind of food that you're serving.
Sure. So Uplifter's Kitchen actually opened 5 years ago as a great community spot, and we reopened it in August as a vegetarian restaurant, but, you know, still supporting the community, and we feel super supported by the community as well. But we're vegetarian, and we have things like dal on the menu, some samosas, so we're really, really influenced by global flavors as well.
Yeah, I understand that you're here today shopping for ingredients for your breakfast burrito. Tell us what you're shopping for.
Yes, we just put a breakfast burrito on the menu, basically a mashup of all my favorite breakfast burritos kind of in one. So we're shopping for Weiser potatoes today.
And what variety are you buying?
Peewee potatoes predominantly, but we love the purple and the beautiful rose color potatoes as well.
And for a breakfast burrito, so much of it, for me at least, is about texture. So how are you cooking the potatoes to get the desired result that you want for the burrito?
We use a great olive oil and super high heat oven, and we get a really nice crispy exterior. We season the potatoes with some rosemary, some salt, and some garlic. And then you get those really crunchy, crispy potatoes that go well with the creaminess of the burrito.
Yum. And what else is inside of it?
We're doing refried beans using primary beans, an organic bean company that uses beans from farms all over the U.S. and Mexico. And we also have Tillamook cheddar cheese, eggs, and a cashew chipotle aioli.
Mm. Do those potatoes end up anywhere else on the menu, or is it specifically for the burrito?
You can order them as a side as well.
So on top of your regular menu, you're also one of the dozens of women restaurateurs around the city who are participating in Regarding Her Food, which is a 10-day festival of collaborations and events happening all week long. Tell us how you're involved.
So right now we're partnering with Botanica in Silver Lake to bring a little bit of Silver Lake out to Santa Monica, and we're doing a pastry swap with them. So we gave them our carrot ginger almond cake recipe and cinnamon donut recipe, and they give us a chocolate olive oil cake and a honey nut squash muffin.
Awesome. Well, Salima, it's so great to meet you. I can't wait to try this burrito and those pastries.
Thanks, Jillian. We look forward to hosting you.
That was Salima Saunders of Uplifter's Kitchen in Santa Monica. She is serving delicious vegetarian food Tuesday through Sunday from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Kenny Jung has been working on and off with Alex Weiser for a few decades now. If you shop the market, you definitely know Kenny. He's probably helped you, you know, pick out your watermelon in the summertime or decide what potatoes to buy. And Kenny, we were just talking to Salima about Weiser Family Farm's claim to fame, which is the amazing potatoes you grow. There are so many varieties this time of year. Can you just give us a refresher on each type and the best cooking application for each kind?
Sure. We have the French fingerling. They're the red, the yellow inside. I call them kind of the Rolls Royce of a Yukon Gold, a very creamy potato. Then we have a Peruvian blue potato. And with the blue in there, that means the iron content is very heavy, usually nutty and sweet. And the Russian banana fingerling, which is also a yellow flesh, a little bit semi-waxy potato. I think if I had one potato in my closet, I almost would use them because you can use them for anything. And then the almondine, or the which is a red flesh, a little bit more waxier than most, and a great tasting potato, actually. With them, the application I usually do is 375 to 400 degrees. I fork them and aerate them if I don't cut them up. So you could, if you use them all in a mix, which I do a lot, they'll evenly cook. I have an old Merritt O'Keefe oven. So mine, between 375 and 400 for, let's say, 40, 45 minutes, it usually works. I would just fork them and taste them once it gets to around 42 minutes to make sure you're where you want it.
So what about mashing potatoes? I'm sure you get this question at Thanksgiving every year, but people are eating mashed potatoes all year long. What would you recommend for a masher?
Well, the French fingerlings are awesome to mash. And also is the Jerusalem artichokes, also known as the sunchokes, are fantastic with them. And you don't have to peel. I leave the peel on myself because there's a lot of nutrient and flavor in the skins. So I do a French fingerling or a Russian banana. And along with, for a special mashed potato, I throw the Jerusalem artichokes or sunchokes if they're in season at that time.
Okay. Now, Salima was talking about your peewee potatoes. Are peewees just smaller versions of the other potatoes?
Yes, they are. They're the same potato, just a smaller just a smaller size. I almost say the children's services take them almost away from us for having them on the table at such a small.
They're just babies.
Yeah. They're just young kids.
Okay. All right. And then my personal favorite potato that you sell here at the stand is the Magic Myrna. Describe that one for us.
And the beauty of the Magic Myrna, too, is also known as AKA Alaskan potatoes. And those are also, in a way, like the French fingerling. The fact that the farmer himself named it over his wife showed the love not only he has for the potato, but for his wife herself. So it's truly a thing of beauty.
And so romantic.
Yes, it is.
So let's talk about storage. When we take these home, are we leaving them in the counter, in a drawer, in the fridge?
Well, the two things you don't for your shelf life of your potato is you don't want sunlight or moisture. You kind of want to duplicate. They're part of the underground scene. And potatoes are basically 4 inches underground and then 4 inches mounded with dirt up top. So you want a cool, dark area. Keep sunlight away from potatoes.
Okay, and if we happen to get any of those little sprouts or green spots, can we just cut them off and eat them?
You can. It's when a potato turns green that you really want to get rid of them. Now, what that's telling you is actually that there's no sprays on that because they're trying to reproduce at that time. And if they were sprayed, you wouldn't have that. That's growth of the potato. So I do. I cut them out. But it's best to you know, get what you want, the amount that you can eat. And protect them from sunlight and protect them from moisture and eat them and just renew themselves every couple of weeks.
All right, Kenny, thanks for all the great tips.
Thank you very much. Bon appetit.
That was Kenny Jung. You can find him at many Wiser Family Farm stands around Los Angeles at the Farmers Market, including Wednesday and Saturday, downtown Santa Monica, Friday in Venice, and Sunday either in Mar Vista or Hollywood. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or in KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks go to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, Victoria Alejandro, and Paul Smith. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. It is time to revel in the sensation of breathing out all that accumulated tension and have a great takeout meal. Check out the many collabs happening during the Regarding Her 10-day event. We'll have a link for you on our website. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.